I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Putting itself front and center in the debate about keeping marine mammals in captivity, the National Aquarium in Baltimore is considering retiring its 8 dolphins and moving them to a first-of-its-kind ocean sanctuary. It's part of the aquarium's deliberations on its future role as a conservation organization in a world beset with environmental challenges. The aquarium's CEO, John Racanelli, joins us today to talk about his institution's evolving mission. Also on the show, a conversation with Robin Haas, the chef owner of Birateca in Baltimore. And in the second hour, Midday on Film with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. Today, an appreciation of Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, 20 years after its release. First, the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. The second hour of our show today, it's the June edition of Midday on Film. Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, our film critics, will be with us again. They wanted to talk about Pulp Fiction this month, Quentin Tarantino's film that was released 20 years ago this year. So that'll be the subject of our show, Pulp Fiction, in the second hour of our show, Midday on Film. Right now, we want to welcome John Racanelli to our show here in the first hour of Midday. He is the CEO of the National Aquarium in Baltimore, which is doing some serious rethinking about its mission. So we invited John on the show today to talk about this. John, nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Dan. Good to be here.
The news got out a few weeks ago about the dolphins. The National Aquarium is considering releasing its 8 bottlenose dolphins and putting yourself pretty much at the forefront of a debate about keeping marine mammals in captivity. But this is all part of a big plan and rethinking about the National Aquarium's role here in Baltimore and in the country, right?
That's exactly right. All part of a larger project that we're working on called Blueprint. But let me correct one thing. Releasing is a strong word. What we are looking at is finding a new home for the dolphins, possibly.
Yeah. Releasing suggests releasing out into the inner harbor or the ocean or something. And I understand. We'll talk about the specifics of that.
And that's a fate I wouldn't wish on my best friends at this point in time.
Right,
although over time, hopefully, it would be nice to be in the inner harbor.
Before we get to the dolphins, then, I want to ask you a question. You came in as CEO 3 years ago.
Yep.
So what was your assignment? Was this part of your assignment to re-strategize about the National Aquarium?
Well, first, a tiny bit of history. When I first got into the aquarium business, and I'm almost embarrassed to admit that was 40 years ago, but in 1984, I really started in earnest in this world and went to the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California. And the first step was you got to get out to Baltimore and go to Mecca and see the one that started it all. And I came here in the summer of 1984, 30 years ago, to visit the National Aquarium. So this figures prominently in both the evolution of aquaria nationally and also in my own evolution. I did come here with a bit of a mandate from the board of directors, and it was to really focus on the value of the aquarium as a conservation entity, as an organization that could inspire people to want to do more than just come in and be entertained by ocean habitats and inhabitants, but also really to focus on what's their role, what's their part in all this.
What makes you and others think that people want that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the reason that we have a sense that they do is, first of all, we're living in a time where we just get a continuous flurry of bad news. I think you touched on this in one of your columns recently, this whole notion that it's just all doom and gloom, which we realize that's not what happens in aquariums. In fact, in an aquarium experience, there's a lot of really beautiful, incredible, insightful things that happen. There's a lot of social bonding with the people you're there with. There's this interesting emotional bond that you can build with the animals that you see. It's an opportunity. Their minds are really opened up when they're in an aquarium. We know that from research. We even know it from conducting brainwave studies on people wearing a bizarre little hat that measured their gamma brainwaves. Their level of receptiveness is higher in aquariums than in most other settings for at least some portion of their visit. We have this chance to talk to them in an open way and in an honest way and in a hopeful way to get them to think about what role they might play in caring for watersheds, bays, rivers, deltas, and the oceans.
Are you concerned that the idea of going to an exhibit of animals in captivity, be they marine animals or mammals on land, a zoo, is going to go out of fashion?
You know, this is a question that is asked daily by the people in the business that I'm in, and there are nuances to it, of course. I think that failing our capacity to create realistic, painstakingly recreated habitats, then I think we don't have any business being keeping those animals in a captive setting any longer. I think we have to be able to replicate the kinds of habitats they come from, A, for the sake of the animals, to be able to behave closely to the way they do in nature, and B, for the sake of the humans, to see these animals in context and understand their role in nature and in the world that we are a part of. So that's where, frankly, the dolphin decision is really crucial. One habitat and one species that we're not able to do that for at the National Aquarium is our dolphins. We really can't replicate the kind of habitat they live in because it would take 10 Pier 4s to do that. Also, dolphins are smarter than humans. They go south for the winter. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there are populations that live in southern waters, Florida, the Carolinas, the Gulf Coast, year-round. And so when we look at the possibilities of an open-air setting, an oceanside type of setting for those dolphins, it's generally in those states that we need to start looking. And that's part of our inquiry right now.
Let's talk about that then. I'm curious about it. You say it's part of your inquiry, so it's up in the air. This is something being discussed and thought about, a first-of-its-kind ocean sanctuary, an oceanside sanctuary. And can you give us some ideas about that? What might that look like?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, in the zoo profession, there are now, sanctuaries for almost every mega mammal, or what people in our trade call the charismatic megafauna. But it just means the big mammals. And elephants, rhinos, every species of large primate, even animals like dogs and parrots have sanctuaries now. And for whatever reason, we don't have that yet for marine mammals. It's mainly been, I think, a question of economics. It's not an easy thing to do. It's one thing to buy a hilltop and put a fence around it and say this is the elephant sanctuary. It's quite another to do the same with a patch of water for dolphins. So that's the first step, is looking at, you know, what are the key parameters that we would need to do. And location, size, timeline, these are not, back to the original statement, we are not looking to simply turn these guys loose in the ocean. We are looking to develop what we've actually been viewing as a national dolphin center, a place where the dolphins go maybe to live out their years, maybe to, we'll certainly be able to do research that enhances our understanding of the dolphins. And one of those areas of research could be whether or not a captive-born dolphin can, in fact, be re-released into the wild and successfully make that transition.
Because you don't know that, do you?
No one knows.
Right. And the 8 bottlenose dolphins that are at the National Aquarium in Baltimore were all born in captivity or not?
7 of the 8.
7 of the 8.
Nani, our 42-year-old, which I'd like to think 42 is pretty young nowadays, and for humans, let's say it is, but for dolphins, it's well along. Though dolphins live, and there's even been one that was known to live to 61 years of age, so she could have 20 more good years in her life. We'd like to make sure that if, in fact, it's not in Baltimore, it's going to be somewhere where she can really enjoy those 20 years.
So, John, I'm trying to get a picture of this in my mind. We're talking about a sanctuary that involves a fence, a barrier of some kind to contain the marine mammals, these dolphins, but a large expanse of water, obviously, a real natural habitat, yet limited, right?
Yeah, consider it it would be natural seawater, ideally. It would be as large as reasonably possible, probably with some kind of portal to a space where you could still bring the dolphins back to, both for all kinds of different needs, veterinary care, isolation if one of them was sick, and also particularly in the southern latitudes, the need for some kind of shelter if there's a hurricane or other kinds of extreme weather, or some of these human-induced threats that now face animals in the wild, such as Morbilla virus. Well, we don't know where that's coming from. Oil spills, red tides, those are a little bit more easily traced back to human activities. In all cases, If you've got a group of dolphins in a setting like that, say in the Keys or somewhere in Florida, you've got to be able to isolate them from the ocean if one of those threats was coming their way. Or they've got to pick up and leave, which is a much more challenging thing to do.
So this is really new territory.
Very.
This puts the National Aquarium on the vanguard of this. And my question is, are other aquariums interested in doing this as well? Are they rethinking their mission and also their keeping of marine mammals?
You know, out of 22 major aquariums in the country, there's only four or five, I'd say, that are still in the business of keeping marine mammals, cetaceans, that is, mm-hmm. whales or dolphins, in their aquarium. So most have made that call already. And for those that were in this trade, they've gotten out of it. And others were perhaps came into the game late enough that they decided never to even enter the fray. It is changing. As we've talked, you discussed, I think, very well in your column recently, the emergence of, you know, the millennials, Generation Y, whatever we choose to call them, 92 million Americans, making it the largest population cohort in the history of the nation. And their attitudes are very different from that of their forebears, the vaunted baby boomers that I think you and I get to call ourselves. Mm-hmm. We grew up with Flipper. They grew up with the Cove and Free Willy. It's a different pop culture, but also a different level of information awareness. I mean, 23 channels of nature programming on cable television, they've had access to a lot more of this information. So I think we believe that audience that we're going to be, our purpose is to serve. For the next 30 to 40 years, that audience, is its attitude is changing enough that we need to pay attention and figure out what's most applicable to their lives.
Who's working with you on this?
We've got quite a, mainly it's an in-house team right now. But our partner in this, in the design side, and I want to touch on Blueprint for a moment, is an incredible firm called Studio Gang Architects, named after Jeannie Gang, the MacArthur Fellow genius, incredibly creative lead person of that firm. And she has been an outstanding partner in this, really looking at things very, very differently than is the norm.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
she's worked on aquaria and zoos.
This is one of the things I like. She has done a couple projects for Lincoln Park Zoo, but she's never done any work for an aquarium, and that was one of the reasons that we picked her.
Oh.
I'm a great fan of some of the great architects like Peter Chermayev, who designed our aquarium, or the Escherich, Homsey, Dodge, and Davis out in San Francisco, who have done several as well. But this was a time we needed to look beyond the normal kind of mode and think about the ways that we might be able to reimagine the National Aquarium in the years to come. So the biggest pillar of this blueprint is really reimagining what we're going to do here, how we're going to bring our entire campus back together, because we're spread all over the city, as you might know. What will we do in Pier 4 if, in fact, the dolphins are no longer there? It's a world of possibilities, but it's also a significant enough challenge to repurpose a space that was built 23 years ago for a dolphin pavilion.
John Racanelli, the CEO of the National Aquarium in Baltimore, is our guest in this hour of Midday Friday. You're welcome to call and join me in asking questions of John Racanelli, 410-662-8780. How would you feel about the dolphins being finding a new home for the dolphins, retiring the eight bottlenose dolphins and moving them to a first-of-its-kind ocean sanctuary? 410-662-8780 is our number, our midday email address for questions that way, midday@wypr.org. A short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. John Racanelli is our guest here for this next segment of the show as well. 410-662-8780 if you would like to ask John a question. I have a question for you. You mentioned that there were only, four or five remaining aquaria with cetaceans, with marine mammals?
Correct. With cetaceans, yeah,
okay.
Dolphins and whales.
Okay, but there are also dolphin and whale shows still separate from some of those places?
Or? There are still what are called marine parks, which is the SeaWorld, of course, is the sort of biggest example of that. And then the third model, and the one that I think is actually an area of some concern, is the emergence of these dolphin swim operators who are springing up all over Latin America and the Caribbean. They don't follow the same rules that zoos and aquariums do. I might add that SeaWorld, ourselves, all the key zoos and aquariums in the country belong to an association called the AZA, the American Zoo and Aquarium Association, which has incredibly rigorous accreditation standards that we all have to pass once every 3 years. Some of these swim operators are good players, and others maybe not so. And that is an area of concern when you think about the welfare of these animals.
John, I wish you'd talk a little bit about this idea of the National Aquarium being a conservation organization that owns an aquarium versus an aquarium with some conservation mission. Just yesterday, I wrote a column about the Baltimore waterfront and how grand it is. It is great, and there's more ambition to redevelop parts of the waterfront. People get excited about having property on the waterfront. This used to be all industrial, you know?
Yep.
And now it's become more and more residential and even commercial and office space along the waterfront. And I don't mean just in Baltimore City, you know. So, but the water's terrible. Our harbor still gets an F grade. We have the Waterfront Partnership working hard here, Chesapeake Bay Foundation working on the bay, lots of different organizations working toward this. And we don't seem to be making a whole lot of progress. Most of the reports we see are still pretty grim in terms of water quality.
Yep.
And the animal life in the water. So talk a little bit, please, yeah, about the National Aquarium. What do you see as the possible role for the aquarium in all of that?
Well, we absolutely have got to make that a key priority. And we have decided that we've been turning our back on the harbor for too long. When the aquarium was first built, I can imagine why they didn't really want to open very many windows onto the water. The shipyards were across the way, although as a maritime guy who first came here on a sailing ship, for me, that's sort of cool. But yeah, I understand that was really the motivation at that time. I think we have an opportunity here to pick up on what Mayor William Donald Schaefer and other visionaries did 33 years ago and make Baltimore's Inner Harbor and the city itself a model for other cities throughout the country by creating a model for a healthy, thriving urban waterfront. And I think it's our job to be a big player in that, along with partners like Blue Water, Baltimore, the Healthy Harbors, and of course the CBF and others.
You mean make the water healthy?
Make the water healthy and show that you can have a green and thriving waterfront in addition to the kind of urban uses that we're so used to and that make this economically viable. I'd say this, first of all, we take our role as the economic engine here very, very seriously, and we would never do anything that jeopardizes that. That's sort of openers. You can't, you know, that's our jacks are better. We can't make any choices about the aquarium that would somehow compromise its capacity to be such an important part of the crown of jewels that is the Inner Harbor. But I think we can do more to get, you know, the mahogany tides are starting again, and I find that depressing. I live on the water down in Canton, and I love it. And frankly, every day it reminds me that this is why I'm here, is to help the rest of my fellow residents of this city and the state and beyond and the whole watershed get this Chesapeake to a level that of health that it deserves to be.
Well, since this the word got out about your blueprint and the rethinking you're doing about the aquarium, have you heard from some of the partners along the waterfront about maybe the aquarium taking the lead here, being sort of the clearinghouse? I don't know if that's the word. Just being the point place. What's the word for that, John?
Well, I mean, it could be a point place.
Where everything comes together, you know, because there are all these volunteer efforts. There are nonprofit groups. There are the business group, the Waterfront Partnership.
We touch, 1.3 to 1.4 million people a year directly via their visits to the aquarium, along with all the others that we get to through all the other means. But what's important is that's an audience that is not a traditional conservation organization audience. It's younger. It's often people that are not necessarily already engaged in these kinds of activities. So we have a chance to get through to them with a message of hope, not of gloom, because there's nothing worse than going to a zoo or aquarium and walking out of there feeling worse than you did going in.
Right.
But most importantly, inspiration. So we have these three drivers that are really our checkpoint, our touch points for whether or not we're being effective. First is, are we delighting our guests? Are we making them feel really great and inspiring them? Second is, are we in our every work process that we do delivering a more secure future, both economically and also environmentally? And the third, and the one that I really focus on, is, are we driving conservation action? So we've always had this quiet, one of the things I was very pleased about when I came here was how the aquarium had been quietly and fairly unassumingly going about its conservation activities around the bay, have preserved over 200 acres of shorelines, have planted something like 1.5 million native plants and trees and shrubs and bushes, all that, cleaning up shorelines, but weren't really using that bully pulpit to expand the message more broadly. And that's part of what we're trying to do now.
I'm not sure how aware people are of those activities by
It's one of the better kept secrets.
You have all kinds of programs going on.
It's true.
You spend some time on your website, and even I wasn't aware of all of this.
Well, and I think that's the thing, is to try to drive more traffic there, because that then leads to all these different activities people can do. But the other thing I want to mention is that we are really motivated to refocus our next round of exhibits are going to be, first of all, on shorelines. And so we have a really cool new exhibit that's going to open in 2015, which is very family-friendly, really focused on young people, people with young kids. And we're bringing back the touch pools, but in a very different way than the olden days. And it's called Atlantic Seashores. And it is going to be, there's two different touch pools, one of which is a jellyfish touch pool, kind of a unique idea. The other is for the fish and the rays and skates and horseshoe crabs, but a very, very much focused on how to do it sensitively and not in a way that injures the animals of the shoreline. And it also focuses on shoreline heroes, people that have been doing their part to enhance and improve the health of our shores. That's the first piece of that. The next will be about the Chesapeake itself.
I always wonder, you know, when kids especially have that experience of going to the aquarium, how do we know what they take away? What do they take away with them? Does it carry over into their thinking as they become adults and part of the world? Do they understand how connected everything is? Even the recycling they do at home is somehow connected to all of this. You think that there's more of those connections made today than in the old days?
I know it was purely entertainment. No, I know there are, and I know some of it's anecdotal, but we have done some quantitative studies, and we participated in a study with an organization called the Ocean Project. It was done in Houston, particularly Houston, because it's a young city, it's an oil city, it's not Portland, and it was a place where we figured if we can make a blip on the mark on in the attitudes around ocean conservation in Houston, by God, we can do it anywhere. And it was all about people, it was asking people concept questions about whether they felt they could influence the outcome of for the health of the ocean. And we asked alternative, you know, in oppositional questions about, well, it's all lost, there's no hope. After the campaign was out there, and it was a very simple online campaign targeted totally at teens and tweens, there was a jump of something like 25% in terms of their agreement with the positive statements and their disagreement with the negative ones. But the important thing was, a year later, that level of congruence with those statements had not diminished dramatically. It was down to like 22%.
Oh, that's something of a measure.
So now the next step is give them the actionable items that you can do. And that's something we're working with other aquariums to try to figure out right now, how we can build a national campaign to really take some traction on that.
Yeah, really, we'd like to see the campaign to clean up the harbor, ramp up all of it. We would like to see that. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. Some callers for John Racanelli. Well, he's with us, the CEO of the National Aquarium in Baltimore. Ryan in Baltimore, welcome to the show.
Hi, first-time caller. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go right ahead.
I was wondering, in terms of education opportunities for the aquarium, we're talking about water quality, but mainly the nitrogen and phosphorus pollution in the harbor. And I was wondering if there's any sort of education that could be done in terms of making people more aware of the fertilizer that they put down on their lawn, or greater impacts to the watershed from our daily uses that people aren't really aware of.
It's a great one. It's a good, very important question. A couple things. First of all, there are a lot of water-wise and bay-friendly activities that we are we participate with others, like the Trust and Blue Water and some of the other organizations.
Bay Trust.
Yes. And those, of course, are easily found on the web. But more importantly, we do a lot of programs out there that are focused on trying to improve the health, especially of the shorelines. And keep as much, you know, garbage and other non-beneficial nutrients out of the water, and keep the constituent parts, the things that should be there, like crabs and rockfish, in the water.
Right.
But more than that, I think the other thing that is important for people to know is that you know, there was a lot of controversy around the so-called rain tax, which was an absurd label placed on what really is a legitimate fee. And I'm glad that it passed the legislature this year to focus us on what is truly called polluted runoff. We can call it stormwater because that's what drives the water to the bay, but it's really polluted runoff. And everything we can do, including paying our fair share to treat and manage that water so that when it does get to the bay, it isn't as laden with the kinds of chemicals, again, nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus and other particulates that are doing great damage to the bay. That's a crucial thing, and I'm really pleased that this state has stepped up to do something about it finally.
It's unfortunate the controversy, the criticism of that as a rain tax, the ridiculing of this idea without understanding the science of it.
Right, that's
really
true.
Really. Well, but you know, how do you counter that message then? That it's just another tax. How do you counter the message? You need a sort of repeated message to people that what you do on your home, on your street, at your business does affect the water quality downriver, downstream, in the harbor. You may not have property on the waterfront, but this is your community.
Yeah, well, and remember, everybody's downstream of somebody, no matter where you live, unless you're on the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, I suppose. But
you need repeated messaging.
Yeah, and to Ryan's point, I think that one of the things we figured out we need to do and what we will pursue and open in 2017 is a whole series of exhibits, both inside and outside the aquarium, focused on the Chesapeake Bay watershed and really getting people to understand what a watershed is, this incredible basin that drains, you know, seven states, is home to 17 million people, is an area larger than really almost any other political entity in the nation. And yet all of it contributes to the quality or the health or the lack thereof of our Chesapeake. So the exhibits that we'll do will include both a redo of the live exhibits on the inside of the aquarium, but also a lot of free accessible exhibits on the outside, including this really cool idea we've been working title is called Eco Slip, but it's to take the slip of water between piers 3 and 4 and build a perched wetland there. Now, perched because floating wetlands, we will also have floating wetlands. We pioneered that here years ago, and I'm a big fan of those. The challenge with floating wetlands is the more successful they are, the more they contribute to their own demise, because eventually they get so built up with the encrusting and colonizing organisms on the bottom, which is, of course, the sign of healthy water, mm-hmm. that they sink themselves. So you can't float a floating wetland that's as healthy as you want it to be for as long as you want it to.
So what would you do in that slip?
Actually build a structure in the slip down the center of it that would enable these wetland, these perched wetlands to begin to thrive and grow at varying levels, both above and below the tide line, and then have it circled with floating wetlands that we would constantly cycle into and onto the larger structure. It would be a visible exhibit for people from the bulkhead itself, from the piers. It would also be visible to kayakers and canoers coming into the slip. And then on the bridge between our two buildings, there would be a great area to pop out and kind of go out on the deck and look down upon it.
Wow.
It'll be a place where we're going to have birds.
So this sounds
fish.
Like something that's actually in the planning stage. You're actually going to do this.
This is the first piece of blueprint.
A blueprint? Wow.
You're hearing it here
that's
for the first
exciting.
Time.
That's pretty exciting.
It is.
Because that's quite a large space you're talking about.
It's significant. And it's a really, I think it's going to, again, as a model, as an opportunity to show what an urban waterfront can look like, I think it presents some really great possibilities.
You'll have egrets.
Hopefully. Great blue herons.
Let's take another call for John Racanelli. Michael in Towson with a question for you. Hello, John. I'm sorry, Michael. Go right ahead.
Yeah, actually, it's a double-part question regarding family memberships and that kind of thing. 5 years ago, my wife and I had twins, and we were given a membership to the aquarium. But the aquarium has a no-stroller policy, so the membership was essentially wasted because there's no way that we could carry the twins in backpacks. We also had a three-year-old at the time. I also noticed that I found that when I went to get my membership, there are a lot of corporate membership that people with corporate memberships that, you know, impeded my getting mine. And that's sort of a petty point. But it struck me that the cost of a family membership is sufficiently high. And maybe he could talk about the difference between, like, what is the role of corporate memberships? Because it seemed like, to me, having paid for it, that these people who worked for a corporation were getting in for free. And I can take my answer off the air.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Michael. There's two parts to that. The first, let's talk about the strollers. It's a tough one. It's one of the most difficult things that the aquarium has to face. And that is that just physically, the space is not big enough to allow strollers. And then you have the escalators and move-a-lators, which would create a safety hazard. So early on, they had to make the very difficult decision to disallow strollers. Now, that was in the days before strollers became the size of small automobiles. And I understand why. We only had one, but all our friends that had twins, especially when the double wides started showing up, but we could certainly see why they had them, because you need to carry all that cargo. There are now even triple wide strollers, as Michael probably knows, and unfortunately those would fill up half the aisleways in most of the aquarium. So we've tried, as I think you know, Michael, we've done the backpacks, and they're a great way actually to get the kids up to the same level as the parents, but at certain ages, they're either too small or too big to be in that backpack, and that presents challenges. And then there's grandmas and grandpas who are really not that great at wearing backpacks full of kids. And, of course, when you've got twins, now you're doubling the burden. There are times, though, and if you check the website and even call in, there are times we do allow families to come in with strollers at lower volume periods, mostly outside the summer. To the membership, the membership still is the best deal out there, and it always will be. And in fact, we are looking at ways that we can enhance the membership value in terms of opening the door. Just this last year, we started doing significantly more member evenings where the aquarium is open only to the members, and it's a benefit that the members get simply by virtue of their membership. Not all people can get there in the evenings, but it's a great way to utilize it. The corporate memberships, just so you know, they pay a lot of money. In some cases, $5,000 to $10,000 a year. It's a really a misnomer. It's really a business membership. Most of our so-called corporate members are mom and pops and small businesses. So, in all cases, they're making their contribution to our bigger purposes, our education, research, and conservation programs, and then they're getting a small benefit of admission from it. I hope you'll keep your membership for many years to come, and I promise we're working on how to make it more accessible for families with little ones all the time.
John, what might happen to the Marine Mammal Pavilion? You alluded to that earlier, that it obviously is something Studio Gang and you will be working on for the future. Do you have any ideas, though? Because that's quite a large space that was built just for the dolphins and originally, I think, some whales. Right.
That's true. It's still too early to go in any kind of detail, except to say that there is no limit to the opportunities it presents. Because the fact is that structure, 25 years old, though it needs a little dressing up here and there, and it's going to be ready for a new roof in about 5 years, the structure is perfectly intact and will be for many decades to come. And the 1.3 million gallon tank that's there, if it did not house dolphins, actually does have a lot of possibilities for what it could be in terms of live animal exhibits. One big idea has been to take the concept that was present during the 10 years that we operated the National Aquarium in Washington, which the theme of which was America's Aquatic Treasures, but what it was focused on the National Marine Sanctuary Program of this country, and broaden that to a much more exciting, more interesting and engaging and immersive experience focused on these 13, soon to be 14, and hopefully eventually many more National Marine Sanctuaries that are located throughout the territories and states of the United States.
As far as the dolphin sanctuary or a cetacean sanctuary, which doesn't exist yet, right? That's a different idea, the oceanside idea. So the aquarium would be, the National Aquarium in Baltimore would be the pioneer of that, right? That's what you're thinking. You have to come up with a plan. You have to find a place to do it. You have to find a system that works. But are you alone in this, the National Aquarium, or is the national organization of a, what is your national?
The AZA.
The AZA involved in it?
Well, actually, AZA has been very supportive. I think more, though, even than that, we do have some partners that we've been talking to and that we'll continue to. And we have a great partnership with Moat Marine Lab down in Sarasota, Florida.
But this is coming from you, though. This is coming from the National Aquarium in Baltimore.
Oh, yeah. We've reached out, too. Correct.
And others may end up using this sanctuary.
There is some reason to think that as time goes on, look, one of the things that I think we know is that there's no public acceptance for the idea that we need to continue to collect big marine mammals, any whales or dolphins, from the wild. It's just a thing of the past. We haven't done it for 20 plus years, but we did it back in the 90s, and others haven't. And in fact, no American institution has done so since 1993. And we really don't think that that's going to change. I think people's attitudes have evolved dramatically on that front. So if you look at that and then you wonder whether belugas, orcas, dolphins are going to continue to propagate in captivity or not, there is some reason to think that that might continue for a while with respect to dolphins. It's a tougher call with the other two big species. But we've made a decision 3 years ago after the tragic deaths of those two calves in 2011 to put a moratorium on breeding here because, first of all, we've really not got any extra space in that exhibit. Our colony of six females and two males, it makes it a pretty full house. But also because we really aren't sure what the future of the dolphin collection is, so why bring more into the fold before we know?
And the dolphin show or the dolphin circus, some people called it, stopped a couple of years ago as well, right?
Dolphin Discovery, we launched in just almost exactly 2 years ago, spring of 2012.
That's the new name for what you offer, folks.
It
is. So you can actually still see the dolphins.
Oh, yeah. And what's neat about it, I mean, listen, it was a function of the fact that on the big days of the summer, only about half of our guests could even get in there to see the dolphins, and they had to pay extra. And the dolphins couldn't do as many shows as the public would have liked if they were able to. So all that combined to make us realize that we just didn't need to continue to do it that way. And I think with Dolphin Discovery, which is a much more open flow of people in and out of the space, there's no additional fee. It's a much more kind of casual environment. I think it's turned out to be better for the guests and the dolphins.
We have time for another call for John Racanelli. This is John in Baltimore with a question about the dolphins. Go right ahead, John.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for the very welcome news about the National Aquarium's commitment to a public stance for marine conservation. I've got two questions. First, what formal alliances do you have with not only other aquaria, but with conservation organizations committed to marine environmental issues as well as the appropriate realms of the U.S. government? And secondly, you mentioned that you've measured the brain waves of people visiting the aquarium to assess their responses. What baseline measures, both ideally non-invasively physiological as well as behavioral, are you doing or will you do to help you determine the effects of the possible relocation of the dolphins?
Hmm. Okay. Well, we won't be able to get the dolphins to do what we got the humans to do, which was to wear a baseball cap that measured their gamma brain waves. But I don't think we'll get that cap onto a dolphin anytime soon. And as John probably knows, invasive research on cetaceans is not only inadvisable, but it's actually physiologically virtually impossible because you cannot anesthetize a cetacean. They have to think about every breath they take for their entire life. They never sleep in the way we land mammals sleep. They sleep half of their brain at a time so that they can get that kind of restorative rest, but they don't actually ever go into an unconscious state. And when they did in the early days of dolphin research, the 50s and 60s, they anesthetized dolphins and then watched them expire right there on the table. It was a terrible thing. Now, to the big point, though, I think there was a couple pieces to that question.
How do you measure their adjustment to a sanctuary? That's one thing, right?
So there are ways that you can observe these animals both in a wild setting and in a captive setting that really helps you determine, you know, kind of what their state of mind is. They have a lot of dolphins that are stressed, or any animals that are stressed, express a lot of stereotypic behaviors, which is picture an autistic kid, perhaps, that sits and does a repetitive movement time after time after time. Similarly, with dolphins and all, frankly, all mammals, I think, ultimately, you can see this if they're really deeply stressed. So we watch for that. We watch also for the kind of social behavioral activities that they would otherwise express in the ocean. And we find that, in fact, in those kinds of settings, we think that there is a lot more of that emulation of natural behavior.
John, is there a timeline on this? My last question. I mean, when should we expect to hear back from Studio Gang and you on the blueprint?
We're still asking a lot of questions. So really, blueprint is we will have a concept plan in place by the fall, but then we need to move. Then we really go into the hard part, which is defining the plan more deeply and raising the money,
raising funds. I was going to say, thank you very much for being here, John.
And my great pleasure.
Yeah, please come back and talk some more about this. John Racanelli, CEO of the National Aquarium in Baltimore, talking about their ambitious plans for a new mission or new vision for the future of the National Aquarium in Baltimore. We'll take a break here on Midday Friday. And when we get back, Robin Haas of Biroteca in Baltimore and a new restaurant will be talking with us about a vegan dinner he has coming up. So please stay tuned. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Get a chance to talk about food here for a few precious minutes with Robin Haas, who is the chef owner of Biroteca in Woodbury. Is it Woodbury? Is it Hamden?
Woodbury, Hamden. It's on the Mill Quarter.
It's on the banks of the Jones Falls. How did you discover that place, that location? And how long has it been now?
We're just getting going on our, coming on to our second year anniversary.
2 years, I was going to say. Yeah. In the summer of 2012, right?
Actually, in the fall. We opened in October.
Okay. So how did you find that location? What did you like about it?
We found it going to Woodbury.
Yeah? Driving around Woodbury?
We kind of like got turned around and drove past it and saw the for rent signs on the side of the building and kind of forgot about it. And then stumbled across it again on Craigslist for a while when I decided to relocate to Baltimore from Guatemala. So looking for a place, and I met with the owner, and it was needed a pretty dire straits.
What was the building, Robin?
It was the building that we have now. That's two buildings, the one from 1883 and a new building built in the 70s.
What was it used for?
It used to be a plumbing supply. Okay. Before that, something with the mills, some type of office with all those mills that are down there.
Okay, we've got to describe where this is for folks who haven't been to Biroteca. I said on the banks of the Jones Falls, it literally is. It's right, like, sort of under the highway in a way. Well, a little bit away from the highway. Pretty close to the Jones Falls Expressway, but it's down under there somewhere. And you get to it.
It's on the corner of, and the back of it's on the corner of Ash and Clipper Mill.
Okay.
So that's the easiest way for people to get it.
So if you go down Falls Road, you make a right on Union Avenue?
You turn on Union Avenue, go down to the third stop sign,
right.
Turn left, and we're up on the next corner.
And there's a lot going on there, I mean, in that area of town. Anyway.
There is. Yeah. I mean, you know, that whole area is blowing up, and there's, you know, a lot of great things happening in the Hampden area and the Woodbury area.
Now, you were in Maryland before as a chef, and then you went away for a while, didn't you?
I never really chefed in Maryland.
What did you do in Maryland?
I was, I did some consulting for Phillips Seafood.
Okay. So you didn't actually cook here?
No, I did some recipes and stuff for them for here, but I actually was hired to help them redesign their menus and become less of a crab house and more of a quintessential seafood restaurant, and I did that in Atlantic City.
Okay. And your last stop before coming back here was Guatemala?
I used to live in Miami, and then from Miami I moved to Guatemala.
Okay.
And I owned two restaurants in Guatemala, in Antigua, Guatemala.
So what was your idea with Biroteca?
Well, when we looked at the space, you know, I wanted something to be friendly, something beer-centric. We had a lot of, you know, we had a lot of taps for craft beers. And I wanted something that was fun and approachable. And, you know, I like family-style dining. It's the way I eat with friends and the way I eat with my family. And people said, you know, well, you don't do Italian food that style. I was like, well, I don't think the Chinese expected to do, you know, family style most restaurants. And I said, I think it can work.
Why wouldn't you do Italian family style?
That's what I said.
I mean, what are you kidding me? That's all about.
There's not many Italian family style restaurants. There are some like Bocca di Beppo and there's some like
Carmine's. Nice idea.
Nothing like what we did. I mean, you know, and what we tried to do is like, we our menu's as far away from as Italian American as you can be. We kind of work on the style of Roman cooking and you know, Southern Italy. You know, I traveled to Italy a lot. One of my favorite cuisines in the world. And I wanted something around cool pizzas, you know. Beer and pizza kind of always works together. And, you know, we wanted to add bruschettas. And, you know, I have a definitive idea about food. And, you know, I've been fortunate to get a lot of accolades about it in my past.
You have. What is your most popular item at Biroteca, would you say? We can't talk about all the beer. It would take too long.
Probably the calamari a la plancha.
The calamari.
Yeah.
Plancha.
We slow cook calamari till it's very tender, and then we put it on a plancha and get it kind of like a little bit, not really crispy, but a little browned off, and serve with capers, garlic, lemon, extra virgin olive oil, parsley. I mean, it's simple, but it's...
And you have some great pizzas there, too.
We have probably the duck goose is probably the most popular one.
I made a broccoli rabe pizza last week with broccoli rabe.
That's awesome.
Now, that would fit right into your vegan dinner,
well,
wouldn't it? You have a vegan dinner coming.
We have
up.
A vegan dinner that's been, it's sold out, but it's...
Oh, it's sold out. Well, that's an interesting experiment.
Well, I mean, we're going to do more of them.
Because you do a lot of meat over there. But
we here, actually don't.
You don't do a lot of meat? Well, we do seafood and meat.
We do. I mean, if you look at our menu, there's not a ton of meat on there.
Okay.
I mean, there's, you know, we got a sausage pizza. We have, you know, duck. But you don't see like a lot of steaks.
We don't
have any steak in the pizza menu.
No.
We don't have a ton of seafood.
But the vegan is new.
The vegan
is new.
So this
is an experiment, and you have a chef who's actually growing vegetables, right?
Well, Melanie.
What's your name?
Melanie Melanero.
Melanie.
Molinaro.
Molinaro.
She's she's phenomenal. She's been my chef now for over a year, and I don't know anybody who has puts more into heart and soul into her cooking than she does. She's I couldn't ask for anybody better than her.
And she grows. She does some gardening.
Well, she grows her own figs. She brings them in, puts them on the menu. We have Frost au Bois, which are growing at the restaurant, which are the tiny little, you know, wild strawberries from France. She grows a lot of vegetables and stuff at home. We have a vegetable garden at the restaurant with heirloom tomatoes and, you know, and kale, you know, Losiento kale, and lots of different lettuces. We can't grow everything for the restaurant, but we try to, you know, we have a little room to do some stuff, so we do it.
I'm curious, you mentioned Melanie has a fig tree.
She's got like seven of them at home.
Do you know how they fared through the winter?
Well, she's had a tough one this year.
Yeah,
they didn't
because,
quite make them.
Robin, I was walking around Little Italy where several folks down there have fig trees in their backyards. Some have them on the front stoop growing right in front of the house. And they look dead to me, all of them. Yeah,
they had a tough, this spring something happened with the fig trees, and we won't be getting a local fig crop this year. But the roots are good, so they'll be back next year.
So you're trying a vegan dinner on June 25th. I thought this was interesting. The menu certainly is interesting. First course is and people hear this and they're going to say, gee, is it really sold out? Mm. Sweet potato pate, mushroom tartare. I thought that was an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have heirloom beet carpaccio. Second course, fava beans, a fava bean and berry salad.
Right.
That's interesting. Fava beans in a salad and with berries. I can see that.
You can use a little bit of imagination. You know, fava beans. You know, they're blanched, they're bright green, they're beautiful. I mean, you can eat them. You can make a mash out of them. You can do a ton of things with them cold.
Here's something I like: a roasted Brussels sprouts.
That's our number two item on the menu.
At Biroteca?
Yes.
I'm not surprised. Donna's does that too over here. They roast them or they quick fry them and scorch them in a cast iron pan. Have you done it that way too? It's really good.
Yeah, I've done it a hundred. I mean, Brussels sprouts are like you put them on the menu and we must go through 100 cases of Brussels sprouts a week.
Really? People really like them.
And in my other restaurant, in Nico Tap House, we do them there also.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute since you brought it up.
That was a nice segue.
Yeah,
huh?
Well, you made your own segue. It's fine with me because I was going to ask you about this. You opened another place in Mount Washington.
I have.
This is Nick. I haven't been there yet. Nickel Tap House.
Right.
And what's the location, Robin?
It's right in the corner of Sawgrave and Kelly Avenue. Right as you go over the Kelly Avenue Bridge, you make like that hard, almost like a U-turn.
Yes. Sharp right.
Sharp, very sharp right.
Yeah.
And we're on the left side, right there in the corner.
Oh, okay. Well, what are you doing there? It sounds, let me guess. More good beer and good bar food. No? What? What are you doing?
Did you read my bio or something?
No. I'm just guessing from the name. It's
kind of patterned after the bars of my hometown from Buffalo. You know, a place you can hang out in. You know, get a couple beers. You get a burger. But we added a lot of roasted oysters, a lot of fresh oysters.
Wings?
No wings.
I'm sorry. When you say Buffalo,
no
I
wings.
Say wings. I'm sorry.
I say Bills.
Okay. I say Sabres. But no wings.
No wings, but we do a beef on Kimmelwick, which is in Buffalo, is just as popular as chicken wings.
What is it called?
Roast beef on Kimmelwick.
Now, someone told me about that during a show we did on hometown food.
Oh, really?
Somebody called in. They said they were from Buffalo and that they missed that.
We have it at the menu.
And what it's a certain bread,
so
a roll? Or?
It's a roll that makes it. It's a Kaiser roll with caraway seeds and sea salt on it. Mm. And then the beef is, you know, cooked extra slow. It's served fairly rare on that row. And
that's a thing in Buffalo?
That's a huge thing in Buffalo.
Beef on Weck.
Beef on Weck.
Okay.
I mean, it is as big as wings in Buffalo.
Okay. So that's at Nickel Tap House. The vegan dinner is sold out. But in Biroteca, again, what's the actual address?
1520 Clipper Road.
1520 Clipper Road. It's down there on the banks of the Jones Falls.
Yes.
In an area
on the beautiful banks of the Jones River.
It's developing greatly down there.
It is.
It is. There's all kinds of places to eat now. Hey, thank you very much, Robin. Nice
Dan,
to meet you.
Dan, big
fan. Yeah, nice to meet
you.
Well, I've been hearing a lot about you, too. Mm. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And he brought some of his own pizza from Biroteca, so we can sample that. And Joe Squared is out there, too. They bring some great pizzas
over
here.
Joe Squared is a great place.
Great place. They bring them over on Friday. Thank you to Joe Squared. Thank you to Biroteca today. We're going to take a break here. We have the news coming up at 1 o'clock. And in the second hour of the show, Midday on Film, the June edition with Linda and Chris. It's all about Pulp Fiction, Quentin Tarantino's film, now 20 years old. So we'll see you for the second hour soon.